Why are you running?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the really important question to address. You know, the reason I'm running is largely based on two things about me. Number one, that I'm a teacher, and number two, more importantly, that I'm a father. So I think, like a lot of teachers, I've been very in tune to the emerging cultural divide and the political broken system that we're all experiencing. So as a sociology teacher and a history teacher for 20 plus years, you know, definitely been in tune to that. And I'm concerned. I think a lot of people are concerned about the direction of our country, not only the politics, but even more importantly, the culture. And so that's where the father thing comes in. It's something that's really driven me to pursue taking on a different angle and kind of developing a platform to raise awareness of what it is that's dividing us. So the one thing that seems to me to be very clear, and I think when you talk to people, you feel this and you see this, is we actually have so much more commonality, right? There's so much more that connects us, particularly to the 18th district, but it is the division that is really being harped on, that is really being focused on. That's, of course, largely through the media. And being somebody that's connected to that, as I mentioned, with an awareness of our culture, I think it's just something that we really need to attack, that we really need to understand what is it that's profiting off of us, try to change it. So those are my big motivational factors. It's been an exciting experience, and we're moving forward.
When you blame the media, you're talking about journalism? Are you talking about social media sites? What are you talking about?
Yeah, well, what I'm talking about is largely the absolutism that has emerged in the type of media that we go to, particularly when you talk about, you know, big news agencies, from your Fox News to your CNNs to your MSNBCs. We all kind of get locked into an ideology. We get kind of, we're in a state of tribalism in our culture, and our media kind of gives us that comfort. But in the reality, what it's doing is it's taking us apart from each other. It's not allowing us to understand each other. And I think social media absolutely enhances that. I mean, it's just kind of the product and how it works. People like certain things, and they will go to certain pages and certain articles that fit more into their ideology. So I think it's a combination of things. I think some of it can be intentional from big media conglomerates that are kind of, like I said, profiting off of some of this, to just the natural development of how, you know, social media works. And it's still in its infancy. You know, as social scientists, we're still really trying to figure out the impacts of social media. So I just think those things are really important things that need to be addressed, and I'm anxious to be playing a role in addressing those things.
Well, if you were elected to Congress, I mean, what could you do about that?
Well, you know, that's obviously a great question. As far as policies and legislation goes, I mean, that's one angle. But I think one of the things that we see our Congress people doing is being advocates, as being people that are speaking out against some of the injustices and some of the concerns and some of the things that are dividing us. So that's one step, certainly, is to be vocal. To use that platform. Number two is to think about, well, what are things that we can do? Part of the problem is the broken system that we see in Washington. One of the things that we've got coming out on our website here next week talks about some of the ideas to address that. I mean, gerrymandering is becoming more and more of an understood problem. It's a problem around the country. It's an issue in the state of Illinois. It's both political parties. It's one that, you know, former President Obama has addressed as a concern. We're seeing the Supreme Court act on it. So that's something that I think we definitely need to see. I would be a strong advocate to push a change in how realignment occurs. Right now in the state of Illinois, of course, it's the state legislature that takes that responsibility. If we did an independent council, an independent group that would step in like other states have done, like Canada does, I think that would alleviate a lot of the problems of the politics and gerrymandering that are created. And then campaign financing is obviously an issue that's gotten out of hand. Some of the people that have the opportunity through super PACs and things since Citizens United came out can throw money after money, you know, just throw an infinite amount of money at candidates. And in the process, they're getting a legislative voice through ALEC and through some of these other things. So there needs to be an effort to try to combat that. That's not going to be easy, certainly, because the Supreme Court came out with a decision in the Citizens United decision. But there are certain things that can be done. Maine, for example, is a state that's pushing to get candidates to try to advocate a fair play system in the financial aspects of campaigns. So those are definitely things that I think a lot of people would agree are being detrimental to bringing us together as a country. I think our democracy is in a state of crisis, and I think that 2016 exposed that. And so I think we need people to come out of different areas. I mean, I'm an educator. Like I said, I see myself as a teacher. I think some people recognize that as a positive thing. There's challenges that go along with it, too. I mean, we're definitely a campaign that is learning and growing and trying to sort things out. So there's challenges to not being in the political game. But I think people are ready to respond to some non-political or apolitical types to get involved. And as somebody that's taught these things, I certainly have an awareness of a lot of the issues and platforms.
So what about money in politics and the Citizens United decision? Do you have a plan, an idea, some legislation that perhaps could work around that without being and still be constitutional?
Well, that's what I was just, discussing is the fact that it is a difficult situation to address because the Supreme Court has, acted on it the way that it is. I think, look, what we have to do is to get the public on board more and more, and then congressmen to feel the pressure from the voters that the people don't want to see this much of deep money in the political system. And that speaks to grassroots efforts. I mean, there are a lot of them that are growing. I mentioned the state of Maine a few moments ago with some of their efforts and their state legislature to create laws that encourage their candidates to forego some of acceptance of super PAC money. Look, I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's an easy fix because it's not. But the first step is thinking of solutions. Those are some of them. When you have people in Congress that are benefiting, of course, from the money that's coming out, the incentive has to be there, right? And I think the incentive starts from the people voicing their concerns and growing grassroots. When you look at a lot of issues in our country's history, they've started at the grassroots level, whatever that might be, from going back to even the pursuits of the 18th Amendment to getting women to have the right to vote. They started small and worked up. And so I think that that's probably the angle that has to happen to get a reconsideration from the Supreme Court on this issue in particular.
How are you funding your campaign, and how much money do you think you'll need to raise?
Well, we're very grassroots. We started this not that long ago. We've been really encouraged. All the money that we've been getting in have been from just regular folks that are out there that have really listened to what we're trying to do and have stepped forward. So we've raised a modest amount of money in the short amount of time, and it's gone quick. We definitely are going to have to increase that, and we're going to have to get support from groups that we are supporting, unions and other organizations that can provide us a little bit more funds. But let's face it, I mean, the Republican side of things have a war chest of money at their disposal. So you need to be creative. One of the things that we definitely plan to do is to be out and to be vocal as much as we can, to try to use social media, which we have been doing to get our message out. And so those are some of the tactics, but there's no question that's a challenge. And I think that that's another issue from an educational standpoint that allows us to address the fact that this is a democracy, but is it fair when the other side has, millions? I think LaHood in 2016 had, I don't want to misstate the number, but it was pushing 2.5, I think, that that had available to run against. And obviously he won, you know, very handily in the 2016 election. So it's a challenge.
Would you support term limits for members of Congress?
Yeah, that question gets asked a lot. You know, the polls show that a lot of people are really in favor of that. I know recently Senator Cruz, even the Republican from, you know, obviously Senator Cruz from Texas, is in the process of getting that started in the Senate. Here's how I feel about it. The short answer is, if things don't change, yes. I mean, congressional approval ratings hover anywhere between 15% to 20%, and that's been consistent from poll to poll for a long time. So unless we get things changed with regards to the amount of money going in, with regards to the gerrymandering issues as far as how districts are aligned, if we can change that and make them more democratic, I think that the term limit situation is one that wouldn't have to be addressed. And here's the problem with that. I mean, you can have very, very significant, very important members of Congress, great leaders, that would benefit our country to stay in longer than whatever the term would be. But it's gotten out of hand. So if none of those things were to change, then I absolutely would be in favor of congressional term limits. In the House, either being 3 or 4 terms, which obviously would be 6 to 8 years, and then the Senate's a 2 terms, which of course would be 12. So, you know, the American people are talking, and the polls suggest that many of them are in favor of it. But that said, there's the other issue to discuss with regards to what that could mean. So if the elections become truly more democratic, then I think that issue needs to really be thought about.
Do you believe we need immigration reform? And if so, what would you like to see in immigration reform?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the short answer is yes. I think most people understand that we need to have a system in place that is reasonable, that we can't just let people flock into our country. I mean, very few people take that approach. But we have to have compassion, and we have to have sensibility to how we make this reform. And, of course, the Dreamers, DACA, all these things are hot in the news right now, and rightfully so. I mean, we're talking about people who are Americans in every way except for, you know, that legal status. They've been here, some of them, from the time they were babies. They've worked hard. They pay taxes. They're you know, involved in the military and in university. And we can't create this a campaign of division. I mean, what has happened since 2016 is language that is toxic to our democracy, and the immigration issue is part of that, right? I mean, when you're using words that are making people afraid, when it's demagoguery is what it is. And, you know, the history books will tell us, as, you know, I've taught U.S. history, as I mentioned, for over 2 decades, that's a very dangerous thing for democracy. So I've got 2 things going on here. Yes, we need reform. It needs to be sensible. We need to have people that certainly follow rules. We need to change, I think, systems in place that are, you know, connected to merit, to work-based situations of merit, are the smart, pragmatic way to go. And I would be in favor of looking at things like that. But we can't be holding people, also going back to the Dreamers, as kind of bargaining chips for other things. You know, the Republicans now are saying, let's get the Dreamers and DACA done and tie it into funding for the wall, when, of course, the whole campaign for that was, it seems like everybody pretty much remembers the emphatic statement of who was going to pay for the wall, and it wasn't the American taxpayer. So, you know, these things are ugly politics that need to change. But, yeah, we definitely need to figure out how we're going to move forward with immigration, because, you know, we've got to set boundaries.
What about the Dreamers? Would you like to see a clear, perhaps easier path to citizenship for them?
Yes, I would. And I think most people feel that way when you look at the polls. I mean, I had the opportunity a couple of weeks ago in Springfield to listen to a young woman speak. And she just represents so many of these people, of these young people, some of them, of course, you know, barely adults. And their vision and their pursuit of the American dream, it's alive and real. That is a group of people that the Obama administration worked to set aside to help. And we can't turn our back to them now. I think one of the things that we're trying to run with in our campaign is this idea of golden rule politics, right? So, you know, the idea of let's do the right thing. The right thing to do is to make sure that the kids that are the young people that were part of this, the Dreamers that are associated with DACA, get their citizenship, move forward in our country, and are protected to stay in the country. And that just needs to be done. It needs to be done in a clean way, separate from other, you know, things. Like I just said, connecting into the wall, that's just dirty politics in my book, and I think in a lot of people's books. So, yeah, it needs to get done.
What role do you think the federal government should play in K through 12 education and in higher education, for that matter?
Yeah. Well, you know, education in the United States, the public model that goes all the way back to the early 19th century with Horace Mann in Massachusetts, is one that is largely funded and advocated and curriculum set at the local and the state level. And that should remain. I think that's the way it should be. The federal government has a role, and the federal government has had a role for a long time. I mean, it was our own Abraham Lincoln through the Morrill Act in the 1860s that first established federal money for learning and higher ed. And since then, we've seen a lot of things develop, you know, in the 60s with Johnson and the efforts of bringing a lot more federal money into schools. Look, we are a connected society. We are a connected world. And our education needs to follow suit with that. So we have to have commonalities. We can't have things that are so vastly different in, you know, Kentucky versus Michigan or whatever with regards to how things are taught ultimately. It doesn't mean that we necessarily have to have a common core. I know that's something that's some people advocate and others don't. But as an educator, I can tell you this. We need to have in our schools the best and the brightest people. We need to completely change our society's viewpoint on how we see education. I've had the experience of teaching overseas. And one of the things that I've experienced, you know, in that role was education is viewed differently in Switzerland and in other countries around the world than it is in the United States. We've lost that. There's kind of this demonizing to the public model. And I would strongly be an advocate to change that. Teaching should be the most noblest of professions. We have to have incentive programs put into place to get young people and to keep good teachers in the classroom, because people are wanting to get out of the profession. There's so much to it now, and that's a huge problem. I mean, we have a crisis. Teachers are leaving the profession. Public schools are kind of losing their respectability. They're losing their desire. I understand, as a parent, you of course want to send your kids to the very best schools, but with some of the programs that are being advocated now, it's leaving a lot of the schools behind. And this goes back to the connection of our society, right? If we don't help other schools in other situations, then ultimately it's going to negatively impact all of us. The federal role of education needs to be in place. It needs to be one that sets the tone for how the states and the local governments go about making their decisions. So it's a combination of all three levels. The state and the local government playing the most critical roles in each district, but the federal government kind of hovering over that and keeping things connected in what is the 21st century. Our schools need to adapt to that.
And then what about higher education? Does the federal government have a role in that?
Again, I think it's a similar type of thing. They have had a role for a very long time, and I think that through, you know, the Pell Grants and things like this, they played an important role in getting kids opportunities to get into schools. But our problem now is that, you know, schools are in the state that they are. The tuition rates are extremely high. And in the state of Illinois, with our, obviously this is close to home with Western, but, you know, they're in Macomb. Kids are choosing not to go to school because of all of those reasons, because of the high tuition. So we need to just sit down as an entire society at all levels, from kindergarten all the way up through university, and rethink what the priorities of education should be, how they should be funded. The federal government needs to play a role on that. Money needs to be kind of reprioritized in that sense to fit into making sure that it becomes affordable. I like some of the things that are happening when you look at the situation in New York and how they figured out a way through their system to get kids to have tuition free if they're under a certain income. That's the direction that we all need to head. The state of Illinois is in quite a fix right now, and there's a lot of things that need to be sorted. But to answer your question, yeah, there's no question the federal government needs to play a role in advocating and funding for our public education at the higher level.
Is there something the federal government can do or should do to help college graduates with a student loan debt?
Well, again, what are our priorities, right? I mean, what are our priorities as a society? I think we need to rethink about where education falls in that. So, yeah, I think that there needs to be systems in place, more creative ways, extension of the Pell Grant potentially for those that qualify. The debt is a huge issue. You know, some of the models in the Netherlands, for instance, with regards to paying back schools, it's based on job availability. When students, they graduate, get jobs, not until then are they required to pay back certain aspects of their debt. It's all in the system. It's kind of molded and fused into the whole model of how their governments fund public education. There's even, you know, Denmark, for instance, actually pays kids to go to school. They get a stipend on top of their free tuition. So these are doable things. It's about prioritization. It's about what are our interests. We spend a lot of money in a lot of areas. You know, I would be an advocate of just making us rethink that, and I would be a strong supporter of creating legislation that would ease the burden on our students before and after they get out of university.
Yeah, you just said we spend a lot of money on a lot of things. Do you think we need a smaller federal government? And if so, where would you cut or what would you prioritize?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily about being smaller or bigger. I mean, obviously, our debt is always a concern. Our budget is vastly spent on our military, and I don't think anybody thinks that we shouldn't spend a lot of money on our military. Of course, we need the safety. But there are opportunities to fine-tune, to go through. I think we can be more meticulous. There's a lot of waste. There's a lot of pork, and that's kind of stuff that you see that really gets, you know, the American public outraged with the carelessness of how we spend things. I think most people think it's not necessarily that we're spending money, but how are we spending it, and is it going into the right places? And that's from, you see stories of the military spending money in the wrong ways. You see it in the Medicare, in any area. You see programs that seem to be ridiculous. So I think we need to fine tune. We need to go through it and really have a conversation about, you know, what are we spending our money on? But also you need to look at what is an emerging system that benefits the extreme elite wealthy in our society. I think that the recent tax plan is a perfect example of that. I know that the Koch brothers and their and those types of people have spent a whole heck of a lot of money, millions upon millions of dollars, on a campaign to get the regular people, to get a lot of people in the 18th district, working class, middle class people, to think that this plan is beneficial for them. I'm very skeptical of that as a history teacher, because it is a kind of certainly a trickle-down approach, and it is the top percent, the 1% that are really truly benefiting off of this model. So getting to my point, you know, there was discussion. Trump even promised, let's close some of the loopholes that exist for hedge fund manager and things of this nature. I was reading some research lately that it could get onwards of up to $18 billion of revenue by just closing some of the loopholes that have been in place that are really just manipulative in the sense that it's putting more money into the pockets of billionaires. So there are different ways. Again, I would use the word priorities. I would use the word awareness that needs to be presented more to everybody. And that's one of the main things that's pushed me into this, in this position as a teacher. I'm not a politician. I am somebody that's just trying to make a difference. I don't really truly have any motivation other than that, with my kids and other people's kids as the center point moving forward, because I think, you know, we've reached a state in our society where we've got to address these things. So, you know, you could use words like oligarchy and stuff, which can kind of have a sense of alarm to them, but you could make the argument that we're there right now, that our country is being controlled by the few very wealthy elites at the top, and they're impacting things from our economy to our politics to how our media is driven.
Regarding the next farm bill, what would you like to see included in that?
Yeah, I mean, the farm bill is coming up here very soon, of course. If I was fortunate enough to get through the primary and move through the general, it probably would already be a done deal. But what I'd like to see is certainly more transparency. I think this goes back to my whole point of elitism, and this is happening in farm. I mean, you have big farm like you have in other areas of our economy, and they're taking advantage of subsidies that have been put into place for a very long time. I mean, going back to the New Deal to benefit farmers. So I think that you could put a cap on some of the insurance premiums that are provided. I think that that could be certainly a money saver, another way to figure out ways to spend money effectively and appropriately. I think that SNAP is something that obviously is a necessary thing for a lot of our citizens in providing opportunities for nutritious food. I mean, these are huge things that a lot of people, you know, in this current administration are suggesting that maybe we should do away with. And I think that that is horrifying to think about. I mean, we have to think about the betterment of our kids, and, you know, the promotion of what they're eating is a big part of that. I would like to see some of the funding for SNAP be used for more educational purposes. I think, you know, specifically to the 18th district, we have a lot of rural poverty, and unfortunately it's growing. And so, I would like to see some of that money going more towards programs that are already in place. There's been money that's been set aside for nutrition programs and things like this, but this could be extended on into even creating programs like the historic kind of VISTA programs or AmeriCorps programs, where young people coming out of school can go into environments like a lot of the rural communities in the 18th district and provide their experiences and boost the educational model that's existent in some of these schools that have been struggling. So to me, it all goes back to education, and it all goes back to the priorities of what we need to be spending our money on.
What do you think is the biggest challenge facing the 18th Congressional District, and how would you go about addressing it?
Well, I mean, I think the 18th District is similar to a lot of places in the Midwest, that we need to continue to find creative ways to keep job opportunities there. The world is changing quickly. We are living in a 21st century world that is a global economy, and that's not going away. And I think we need to be more connected to that. And I think we need to find creative ways to get the 18th district opportunities to be more of a part of that. You know, with the trade agreements and how they've been advocated with Trump, for instance, and from NAFTA to the TPP, as seen as bad thing. I don't necessarily think that that's the approach that we need to take. I don't think protectionism is something that's going to benefit the 18th district. We need to have trade agreements that are going to be beneficial for workers in general, whether that's in the 18th district or not. And that's going to boost things from the middle and working class all over the place. So that would create a true free trade type of an environment. I think that what I'm trying to say is we need to have a better understanding of the connection of the world from certainly an economic standpoint, but in other areas too. And I think that I'm somebody that could, you know, talk about those issues and helping the district move forward in that regard. I think that another thing we need to think about is an awareness of how the politics at play have put this district in one that makes it extremely difficult for people with more progressive viewpoints. They're there. They exist in the district. But, you know, neighboring districts that have taken out more of the traditional Democratic vote in Peoria and Bloomington and Springfield because of the system of gerrymandering, which, again, is not a Republican thing. It's a political party thing. But I think people in the 18th district are starting to understand that that's an issue that creates an election that's just not truly democratic. And so we need to get back into, you know, promoting things for the people as opposed to benefiting those at the top that are kind of controlling things.
Why should someone vote for you in the primary?
Yeah, well, I think that that's a great question, one that is important to ask. And I've recently put out a video on our Facebook page and on our website that talks just about that. Look, I think what I can bring to the table is a unique experience as somebody that's lived throughout the district. I grew up in Quincy. It is in Quincy that I developed, like so many of us in the Midwest, values of hard work, of family, of commitment, of faith, which are still very much a part of what make up the 18th district. And then I've moved on since to Morton, where I taught for almost 20 years. I've lived in a lot of places in between. I've had the opportunity to live overseas and see things from a completely different lens, that we are a connected world, that the 18th district can play a large role in that. But I think mostly what I bring to the table is that through my experiences as a history teacher, as a sociology teacher, but probably more as a coach, that I know that we have so much more that connects us and that unites us, and that I can be somebody that can motivate people, that I can bring people together. People are tired of the cultural divide and the political broken system. I know that for a fact. It is something that has drawn me to the race, and I've learned a lot of people feel that way, whether they are progressive or whether they're conservative. This is a conservative district, but people are independent-minded, they're kind-hearted, they're ready for a change, and I think I'm somebody that can bring people together, and I think that's why I can maybe separate myself. The other candidates running in the Democratic primary are men of integrity. They are intelligent men. There's no question about it. I have the utmost respect for them, but I think I'm a fresh voice. I think I'm the fresh voice, and I think now is the time. And we've mentioned that before. I mean, this is an era of, you know, I don't know if we've ever seen a situation like we're seeing right now with the development of things and the division that I keep talking about. We need somebody to step forward from a different angle and bring us together, and I think I'm that person.
That should do it. Thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.